is planned women will be able to apply for special forces roles in the military from later this year. This will remove one of the final restrictions on women's involvement in the Australian Armed Forces. Although we may hope that no Australian troops will be in frontline combat anytime soon, certainly not as soon as 2016, it is planned that should such combat occur, women will be allowed to serve alongside their male comrades. To discuss the attitudes of gender that have kept women on the fringes of our military forces for so long, and the important role that women have played in war, despite these restrictions, I'm joined by Dr. Michelle Smith. She's from the Centre of Memory, Imagination and Invention at Deakin University. Dr. Smith, welcome to RN Drive.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let's begin around the beginning of the 20th century and Australia's early involvement in warfare, so the Boer War, for example. What kind of role did women play in the Australian military at this time?
Well, women were really restricted to the roles that had nurturing and caregiving connotations, so basically nursing.
And to what extent did that continue, you know, through the Second and First World War?
Well, really it did continue through the First World War. Only a few hundred Australian women from Australia actually served overseas as nurses. So while Australian women did have a presence there in the war, the restrictions were still great, and there were things called the voluntary aid detachments, which were arose out of the Red Cross, which were civilian nurses, so women who hadn't actually had formal nursing training but served as sort of orderlies, cooks and maids, and Australian women weren't actually allowed to go overseas and serve in the VADs officially, but some women took it upon themselves to get themselves over to Britain and serve in, you know, just under their own terms. So really up until World War II, these restrictions kept women in these formal nursing roles, and only a small number as well.
Was that the same in the British Army and the American Army?
I think women had larger roles in terms of nursing. I mean, their proximity in terms of British women was greater. And, of course, from the Crimean War, women like Florence Nightingale really built up this idea of women as nurses and nurturers and as saving the lives of men in those sorts of roles. But Australian women were relatively restricted. I mean, I think the distance, for one, in terms of travel. But women certainly did die in those early years from Australia and New Zealand on the way to conflicts in ships. Even internationally, women's roles were largely confined to nursing and minimised because of that worry about losing women.
And that was about their safety, or was it concern about continuing to be able to breed and, you know, being able to have children and so forth? So and wanting to protect women who were going to then go on and be the mothers
definitely
of the next generation.
And I think this is why you don't see women entering into the armed forces until World War One in very limited roles. Because this very notion of war is premised on protecting and keeping safe women and children. So you don't want them there in these zones of conflict, but also practical reasons. I mean, women's childcare responsibilities, you know, this is an era in which I think not many women necessarily worked. So the very concept of women leading these sort of independent lives, heading off into military hospitals to nurse was quite, you know, out there and was very brave and unusual for the time for women to leave home and pursue what was, you know, a form of career. So I think we need to see the fact that prior to World War II, not many women were involved in war within a British imperial context. It's because, you know, in general, there were oppositions to women working full stop.
And despite this restricted role, there are, you know, lots of stories of women being praised for their heroism. I mean, even though they were in those caring roles, they were, you know, perhaps been under fire, perhaps called to be involved in rescuing people or so forth. Can you give us some examples or stories in that vein?
Sure. Well, I mean, women, I guess, were in these zones, you know, doing their nursing work, but also we forget that women were also in conflict zones as civilians. So during the Battle of Britain, there were a lot of women. There are records of women's heroism isn't as prolific as men's, I think, because we haven't been looking for women's heroic actions during war. But the Girl Guide archives actually give a list of quite a number of women within the guiding movement who, during the Battle of Britain, saved people's lives. There was one Girl Guide district commissioner who fought a house fire during three air raids while bombs were falling around her. There were other women Brownie leaders who rescued an airman who'd crashed into the English Channel by saving him on a canoe that she paddled out into the channel to rescue him. So, you know, I think when women are placed in these situations where there aren't necessarily the men around to protect them, they were able to fall into the task of being heroic, and we don't tend to hear those stories quite so much as those from the front line.
You've got a particular interest in Brownies and Girl Guides and what they've done in conflict areas. And, you know, that's really interesting because we did a sense of Brownies and Girl Guides being all about selling cookies and, you know, learning how to do knots and, you know, earning badges. But in fact, they've got an extraordinary history of being involved and some quite heroic efforts. Can you share with us some stories?
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, I guess, you know, they sort of really pioneered the fundraising supporting of war. There were a lot of ice creams foregone to raise money for motorised ambulances and, you know, school children across the empire as well were doing this kind of fundraising to buy things like ambulances that could support the war effort. But they also did fairly practical things as well. Some of the older women involved in guiding joined something called the Guide International Service. So that was after World War II. You had these millions of displaced people in Europe who were away from their homes, had nowhere to go, had no resources. So many women who were involved in guiding went through an extensive training program to learn how to go over to Europe, enter some of these zones that were devastated and look after and care for these refugees and their children and help to try to reassemble their lives and instill a bit of dignity in how they were being treated and how they were being repatriated and cared for. So, I mean, that was a kind of fairly huge thing. And these were all volunteer women as well. And I think that's been the story throughout a lot of women's involvement in war, is that many had to basically offer themselves free of charge in order to get to a zone of conflict or somewhere where they could help, because until World War II, when men's absences meant that governments had to concede that maybe women had to play an official role, it took women themselves to kind of get themselves there. And Australian women also volunteered for the Guide International Service, and some of them paid their own fares to get over to Britain in order to do the training, which, you know, had them out in fields sleeping without shelter and, you know, being put through their paces to prepare for a bit of a rougher life once they entered the refugee camp.
And Girl Guides were, correct me if I'm wrong, even employed by MI5 during World War One. What were they doing for MI5?
Yeah, that's a funny story, which it really just only came to light a few years ago. But MI5 needed messengers to send top secret bits of information back and forth, and this needed to be done by humans rather than in code or by any other means.
And by pigeons or something.
Yeah, that's right. And they initially thought they'd get Boy Scouts, you know, because Boy Scouts had sort of semi-military training and, you know, they would be able to do the job. But the boys actually were a bit too talkative and unreliable. And so Girl Guides ended up
Which is against the stereotype, isn't it? This idea that the girls would gossip and the boys wouldn't.
The Scouts honour, they should have been doing their job, but 90 Girl Guides actually are on record as having worked as messengers for MI5 in London, and they were conveying this supposedly top secret information on behalf of MI5.
Let's talk about women in combat now. I mean, you've talked about the kinds of views about women that stopped them being involved in conflict in terms of actual combat roles in the past, the idea that they might not physically be up to it, that they needed to be protected. What are the main, you know, myths around women involvement in combat today?
You know, I think in World War One, it was a very reluctant decision to allow women to even perform civilian sorts of roles within Australia. You know, that was the first time you had the women's auxiliaries of the Navy and the Air Force and the Army being formed. And I think the idea, like most of these groups, weren't able to serve overseas. So one, there's that risk to our women. Our views on that have changed slightly, but I think we still retain the idea that women are ultimately mothers. And when we hear of men who are lost in combat, of course we will sometimes hear that they're fathers, but we accept that those children will go on and be cared for by their mothers, and that largely that will be okay. So I think that we still tie women to being mothers, and the thought of women serving in combat positions goes against those sort of maternal views we have. And also the other main thing that people tend to bring up is the risk of our women being sexually assaulted or raped in war zones. And that indeed is true, and there are risks to women even from within our own armed services. We've heard of, you know, sexual incidents of assault within the armed forces, but nevertheless we forget that there are millions of women in these war zones already who are also at risk of assault and abuse. So I think it's still harking back to these old ideas about protecting our women, and the fact that war in some ways has a basis in trying to protect women, protect children, and protect our supposed way of life, and that that's a male role rather than a female role.
Do you expect the planned full integration of women to the armed forces to go ahead? There's certainly plans that that's going to happen.
Yes, so supposedly by 2016, that would be the point at which all roles would be open to women, that there'd no longer be. Currently, I think there's some minor, small areas that women can't enter into. I think it will continue. I think the intent has been that those barriers no longer need to be there, and that it should be a merit-based process, that if a woman can qualify in physical terms and mental terms, that it should be those factors rather than her gender that determines it. You know, while we don't necessarily want to be engaged in multiple conflicts in the future, I think it's a positive thing if we can break down these barriers that women can't necessarily perform certain roles because they're female.
There's the question of formal equality, i.e. all roles in the military available to women. And then there's the question of substantial equality. So to what extent are women actually going to feel comfortable fulfilling those roles? Will there be a culture to support them? And certainly with some of the things that have come out about the armed forces, about incidences in relation to discrimination and sexual discrimination, that can't engender a lot of confidence in women perhaps thinking about a military career.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and that's a fair point about the formal equality. I mean, we've seen areas that are not commonly entered into by women, even disciplines like engineering or sciences or computing, where fields are open, but you know, the numbers are still skewed in a vast majority to men, and that doesn't encourage more women to enter into an area when it's still fighting a battle in being the minority that's present. So I agree that we may not necessarily see a huge shift in the numbers, but you know, that we do need to make those formal steps, at least as a sign that we don't see women as overall inferior or overall incapable or overall not able to serve in a particular role. And, you know, as to whether we can change those things to even things out a little more in terms of the cultures within the military, I don't know how easy that will be to achieve, you know, in that there are particularly masculinist things involved in warfare and in training to perform a role which basically is going to require you to harm people if it comes to that. So as to whether we'll end up with a substantive equality, perhaps not. But I think we do see, you know, within the US there are substantial numbers of women serving, and cultures can change over time with more women present.
Dr. Michelle Smith, thank you so much for joining us on Anzac Day to talk a little bit about women in combat over time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Dr. Michelle Smith. She's at the Centre for Memory, Imagination and Invention at Deakin University.